You know, and as I was preparing this, these guys in particular, our young people, popped into my mind because I just couldn't believe how relevant this is to our culture. So I've brought them back in, and they're all looking at me, daggers at me at the moment, frankly. But we've brought them back in because it is for all of us, but I just cannot believe how appropriate this is for our culture today. This series is going really well. I think it's absolutely amazing. Today we are looking at Ecclesiastes 3, and we're looking at making the most of time. Before we kind of delve into the passage, there's a few things you have to kind of, with two things we need to get our heads around. That Joff has already covered, but if you weren't here, like our guys up here weren't, you need to understand. The first is this whole concept of gain. So Joff last week talked about gain, about trying to seek after profit, looking out for something that will satisfy and that will last, and searching after that, seeking for it and trying to gain it and grab it. And Joff looked at that last week in terms of pleasure and wealth and achievement. And if you haven't listened to it, go and listen to it. But we need to have that concept in mind about the idea that sometimes we seek after something that's going to last and try and grab it. We need to have that in mind to understand what the teacher is talking about in this chapter 3. The second thing we need to know is this phrase, under the sun or under the heavens. Again, Joff did this last week. Basically, what that phrase means is it's on the earth. So this is wisdom or reflections from under the sun, so on the earth. Not a heavenly perspective, but an earthly perspective. And what's brilliant is in this passage, actually the teacher, he begins to unpack a heavenly perspective after he's looked at the earthly perspective. The last thing I want to just say to you before we begin is a bit of a spoiler alert. So if you don't want to know the end, just kind of tune out now. But the takeaway from this is going to be very similar to some of the points we've had in the last couple of weeks. And that's not because I haven't been listening. And it's not because as a ministry team we got together and go, right, we're going to smash them over the head with this. It's because of the way Ecclesiastes is structured. You know, the teacher is trying to teach us something. He's creating arguments, and he's reaching greater and greater crescendos in these arguments. And so he returns to his points again and again, showing us what we've learned now points to the same thing. So at the end, you may go, oh, we heard that last week, but maybe God's trying to tell us something in there. So anyway, let's dive in to the passage. And we start off with this list of times. Under the sun. And we could go through each of these times and try and recognize them in our lives, but actually what the teacher is trying to do here is show us all the different seasons that exist in life. He starts with one we all go through, birth, and he starts with one we all go through, death. And then he lists all these different seasons in between under the sun. Now, it's not an exhaustive list, because obviously that would go on and on and on, but it's meant to kind of show us an exhaustive list. He's showing us all these times under the sun. And you can read this as really depressing. You know, there's a time for joy, but there's also a time for mourning. There's a time for peace, but there's also a time for war. There's a time where everything seems good, and there's a time where nothing seems good. You could read it as this sad poem or lament. And if you're somebody who's seeking after gain, then yeah, that's the way this kind of looks. And so he lists all these things, all this kind of depressing lament. But what the speaker is doing, what the teacher is doing is he's setting out an argument for you. You know, I said how Ecclesiastes is structured brilliantly. Well, this chapter is structured beautifully. And verses 1 to 15, he lays out his first argument. And the argument starts with, look at all these seasons. There are all these seasons under the sun, and human beings have no control over any of them. And you could read that and be like, oh, how depressing. But then verses 9 to 15, he brings in this heavenly perspective. And he says, look at all these times under the sun. Human beings have no control over them. But there is not a single one that is not under the control of God. What we start off seeing as a lament, as a sad song, suddenly becomes the teacher's basis for hope. All of these times exist and we go through them, but God is in control of every single one. He is sovereign in his disposal of every single season. This is his argument in 1 to 15. And if you approach this from a point of view of trying to gain something, trying to work for something, trying to consume things and hold on to them, wow, this is depressing. You get to verse 9. I'm going to read it from the message. And it says, but in the end, does it really make a difference what anyone does? I've had a good look at what God has given us to do, busy work mostly. When you look at things from the point of view of no faith, when you look at it from the point of view of trying to gain something by your own work, it's pointless. It doesn't get us anywhere. It's busy work. And at this point, if you're from that standpoint, this is so depressing, isn't it? All I'm working for is nothing. It's busy work. But the teacher shines his heavenly perspective. And in verse 14, he says, but there is a work that lasts forever. I know that everything God does lasts forever. Which leads us to a conclusion, doesn't it? It leads us to an amazing thing. If you want to do things in this world, if you want to make the most of this time and work for something that's going to last forever, get involved with what God is doing. Because that's the stuff that will last forever. Everything he does lasts and lasts. Therefore, if you want to do something meaningful with your life, if you want to make the most, get involved with what God is doing. Now, I'm not saying quit your job and become a minister. If God is calling you to that, go do it. But I've been reading a lot of C.S. Lewis recently, which will become evident. But one of the things he said was, we don't need more ministers. Now, at this point, I'm like, uh-oh. But he says, we don't need more ministers. What we need is people willing to minister where they are. You know, God is at work at your school. He's at work at your college. He's at work at your work. He's at work in your family. If you want to do something meaningful with the time you're given, get involved with what he's doing. Because that is the work that lasts forever. And what's incredible is there's nothing... Oh, no, we'll come on to that. Get involved with what God's doing. So you can see how this becomes kind of the basis for hope for the teacher. When we shine the heavenly perspective on the fact that God is in control of time, we get actually something amazing. And then he begins to bring us to a conclusion here. In his first argument, he hints at the conclusion. But before we get onto that, I want to talk about the outworking of that conclusion. I know it seems a bit backwards, but you've kind of seen it already when we read through it. But the outcome of this conclusion he brings is simply, if God is in control of time, why are you worrying? You know, whether it's a good time or bad time, yesterday God was in control. Whether it's a good time or a bad time, today God is in control. And tomorrow, whether it's a good time or a bad time, God is in control. Why are you worrying? What is worry actually going to profit you? Why are you worrying? Because God is in control of time. Whether it's a good season or a bad season, he is the one in charge. You know, I read an article recently, and it was about the early church. All right, and it was written... It was written because people had found accounts of the early church, not from the church or from the Bible, but actually from people who were around the early church, who weren't Christians. And it's just fascinating to see what the early church looked like from the outside. And there were all these different hallmarks of what the early church looked like. But the one that struck me right between the eyes was somebody or a few people had said that none of the early church considered their actions urgent because they knew their God was in control. How awesome is that? How awesome would it be to be the church that when people look at us, they see in this age of busyness and rushing around, these aren't a people who rush because they think they're all important and they must get there. They relax, they get into it when they get to it because they know their God is in charge. How awesome would it be to be those people? But it starts with understanding that we don't need to worry about tomorrow. The God who was in control yesterday and today is in control tomorrow. He controls all of time, so we don't have to worry. And so the teacher brings his kind of argument here, God is in control of time, to a conclusion, or he hints at a conclusion. And he says it in verse 12 and 13. So I realized that all we can do is to be happy and do the best we can while we are still alive. All of us should eat and drink and enjoy what we have worked for. It's God's gift. There's the beginning of our conclusion. If God is in control of time, if all these seasons exist under the sun and we could do nothing about them, but God is in control yesterday, today, and tomorrow, then what do? Just enjoy what is in front of us. Now, what he's not saying is go out and greedily consume everything that walks into your path. So right in front of you, you get offered drugs. It's not saying, well, then I'm supposed to enjoy life. I'll take those. You get a chance to just be as, you know, sleep around as much as you want and go, well, I'm supposed to enjoy life. I'll just take that. That's the way to approach it if you're seeking pleasure, if you're seeking gain, if you're seeking the wrong things. What he's saying, instead of trying to greedily consume things, accept what you've been given as the gift that it is. And be present and live within it. You know, a few years ago, Narelle and I went to Iceland on holiday, the country. That'd be really sad, wouldn't it? The country. And I can really recommend it. It was amazing. And we went primarily to see the Northern Lights. And we were so blessed. You know, the first night we were there, we walked out of our hotel and it was just there. But we still went on this tour where we drove out into the middle of a lava field to just in the middle of nowhere just to see it. And it was incredible. Just this blue-green kind of line right the way from horizon to horizon. And it was just kind of slowly, very slowly kind of fading in and out. And it should have been, in my mind, one of the most amazing moments of my life. And I can honestly say I regret that moment. Not because of what it was, but because all this beauty was going on above me and I was looking down. I was looking down because I was trying to get my camera to work. I just couldn't get it to work. And now I look back and I regret it so much because all this time this beauty was going on above me. I was trying to hold this moment. I was trying to consume it. I was trying to take a photo of it so that in the future I could show off to people or I could show it to people or I could look back and hold on to it. Instead of enjoying and being fully present in that amazing moment, I missed it because I was staring at a screen. And this is so difficult in our culture because that's what we do now. We struggle so much to be fully present in any moment. You know, we experience so much of our lives through screens, whether it's camera screens or phone screens or computer screens. And I know you're probably thinking I'm picking on you up here, but I'm not. All of us are just as bad for not living present in the moment that we are given. We distract ourselves. We forget the people around us to be on our phone instead. It's just insane, and it's not what we're meant to do. If you want to make the most of your time, be present in the moment you've been given. Be present in the gift of that moment you've been given. Good or bad, enjoy it for what it is, because that moment is never coming again. If you want to make the most of your time, be fully present in the time that has been given to you. So the teacher initially sends us this argument. God is in control of time. Get involved in his work. It means you don't have to worry and be fully present. Enjoy the gift of that moment it is. But I have a problem with this argument. You know, I struggle. I don't know if anyone else has picked up on my struggle, but I struggle because I have no problem understanding that my God is in control of time. No issue. No problem with the idea that he brings times of joy and peace. But I really struggle with the idea that he brings times of war and suffering. How does that work? How does our good, loving God that we understand is mighty and in control, how does he allow these times of suffering? Well, it seems like I'm not the only one thinking this because the teacher then changes his argument. His second argument is all about injustice. And he begins, in addition, in this world, I've noticed in the place of judgment, where there should be justice, there's injustice. I've seen in the place of righteousness, corruption. He seems to start to wrestle with this difficulty. If we have a good God that is in charge of time, how can he allow times of suffering and injustice? And I believe the teacher gives us answers in this passage. But you're not going to like them. You know, they're not comforting, I've got to be honest. But they are true. And the first one, I think, kind of he hints at is right at the beginning. Right at the beginning of this little bit as he begins to talk about injustice, and right at the beginning of this whole passage, he says, under the sun, under the heavens. We ask, why is there suffering? How could a good God allow suffering and injustice? And the truth is that this is something that exists under the sun. It exists on earth. It was never meant to, but thanks to our failing and our sin, it does exist. Does that mean God is not in control of it anymore? Of course not. But the consequences of humanity's fall is suffering and injustice. God is still in control, but it is something that exists now under the sun. The second one, and this is a tough one, is in verse 11. He says he has given us a desire to know everything, to know the future, but never gives us the satisfaction of fully understanding what he does. You know, we look around and we go, why, God, have you brought this time of suffering upon us? Why have you brought this time of suffering upon my friends, my family, across the world? Why, God? But the truth is, we're looking at it in such a narrow field of vision. It's like there's a massive tapestry in front of us, and all we can see is this tiny little bit, and we're like, how does this work? But God is looking at the whole thing. And even though we may struggle, there is a plan and a purpose. I thought the best way to illustrate this was something I've been reading in a fictional book. I've been reading Chronicles of Narnia on and off, and I've been reading A Horse and His Boy. And C.S. Lewis has written this book, and it's brilliant. Mike's going to come up and read a bit to us. But let me just explain the context kind of as we come into it. So this character, Shasta, is in Narnia, and he's went through all these different troubles and difficulties. You'll hear about them in a moment. And at this point in the story, he finds himself in a pitch black place. Completely dark and alone. Well, actually, he's not alone, he discovers. He doesn't know what else is there. There's something else in the darkness. He can hear it breathing, and then it speaks. And he's afraid, and he thinks it's a ghost. And then we pick up the story.
Once more, he felt the breath of the thing on his hand and face. There, it said, that is not the breath of a ghost. Tell me your sorrows. Shasta was a little reassured by the breath, so he told how he had never known his real father or mother and had been brought up sternly by the fishermen. And then he told the story of his escape and how they were chased by lions and forced to swim for their lives and of all their dangers in Tashban and about his night among the tombs and how the beast howled at him out of the desert. And he told of the heat and of thirst and of their desert journey, and how they were almost at their goal when another lion chased them and wounded Aravis, and also how very long it was since he had anything to eat. I do not call you unfortunate, said the large voice. Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions, said Shasta. There was only one lion, said the voice. What on earth do you mean? I've just told you there were at least two lions the first night, and there was only one, but he was swift of foot. How do you know? I was the lion. And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued. I was the lion who forced you to join with Aravis. I was the cat who confronted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you as you slept. I was the lion who gave the horses new strength of fear for the last mile so that you could reach King Loon in time. And I was the lion you do not remember who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death, so that it came to shore where a man sat, wakeful at midnight to receive you. Then it was you who wounded Aravis. It was I. But what for? Child, said the voice, I am telling you your story, not hers. I tell no one any story but his own.
So if you haven't worked it out, that lion in the darkness was Aslan. You know, Lewis's metaphor for Jesus. And you see how for Shasta it seemed all these things were awful, terrible, all this suffering he had endured. But when Aslan allows him to take a step back, he sees all these things were for a purpose. All these things were for a plan to bring him to this moment of meeting Aslan, to bring him ultimately to the end of this story that ends well. In the time, it seems awful and suffering, and it's how could this happen? But when he's able to take a step back, he realizes there's a plan and a purpose, which is the argument of the teacher in this second section. It's that God has a purpose, even and a plan and a presence, even in times of suffering and injustice. As much as we struggle with that, we don't see the full picture of what God is doing. He has a plan, a purpose, and a presence, even in the place of suffering. The teacher, he rails against these two institutions where injustice reigns, where there should be justice, and corruption, where there should be righteousness. But then he returns to his initial kind of argument. He returns to this idea about time and says, but God is going to judge the righteous and the evil alike. because everything, every action will happen at its set time. He once again returns this idea of time. And he says to us, and he says to anyone reading, there is a time for justice. The time is coming where God's universal justice will reign. It is under the sun that we experience this suffering and injustice, but there is a time where all of this will come to an end. God's time of justice is coming. But again, because I'm flawed and I'm hopefully not the only one, I have an unspoken question as I read this, and it's, why not now? Jesus, why is it not now? Why do I have to every day read or see times where people are making poor people poorer and themselves richer? Why am I seeing terrorism? Why am I seeing tragedies of just accidents? Why, God, is your time for justice not now? Why can it not be now? But the teacher does give us an answer to that. It's not a very nice one, though. It's quite abrasive. Because his answer that he hints at, and we'll look at how he does that, but is essentially, who are you to say that? Who are you? Who am I to say that that time of suffering should that end now? Who am I to say that time of justice should be now? I don't have the full picture. Who am I to demand that justice is now, whereas God, who has the full picture, should know when it is? How on earth am I supposed to know? How dare I ask that when I'm no better than the animals? And immediately, as I'm like, how is that true? How am I no better than the animals? Well, in this context, what is the teacher saying? He's saying, look at the place of justice, there's injustice. Look at the place of righteousness, there's corruption. Look at the way human beings treat each other. Can you honestly say you're better than the animals? You know, Narelle and I went to London this weekend, and we went to the Clink prison, which is really good on the South Bank. It was really interesting. But we walked out just like, I can't believe how inventive human beings are at torturing each other. How inventive they are at evil. Of how to kill each other and hurt each other. It was impressive in its horrificness. Are we really any better than the beast? And if I'm no better than the beast in terms of my mortality, in the fact that I will die and go to dust, and I'm no better than the beast sometimes in my morality, in that I'm like survival of the fittest people, then who am I to suggest that I know when God's justice should be meted out? As I said, it's not a comfort, but it is truth. And so the speaker, having given us our first two arguments, God is in control of time, and even in times of injustice and suffering, God is present, he has a plan and a purpose. He moves on to his final argument, and his final argument it revolves around our eternal destiny. He begins to introduce it by talking about the animals, saying, well, you know, human beings' souls go up and animal souls go down. But he's not teaching us about the afterlife here. In fact, he's really agnostic about it. He's really like, well, who knows? Who knows if an animal's soul goes down and a human soul go up? He doesn't actually seem to know a great deal about the afterlife, or certainly he's not showing us here. In fact, in all honesty, for once, we probably know more than the teacher in this regard, because we live on the other side of the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. We know the hope of resurrection. We know about the afterlife because of what Jesus has done and what he's taught us, whereas the teacher perhaps isn't as aware. But let's not let that one moment where we know more, that arrogance, kind of blind us from what he's talking about. He's talking about how we live in this moment. His argument here is only God controls our ultimate destiny. He, from a point of ignorance, says, I don't know what's after, but I know God is in control. Just as he's in control of time, he's in control of this. We, with our more information, we know what God has done, but that still doesn't mean God does not hold our ultimate destiny in his hands. Because it's not about us earning our way into heaven. It's about what Jesus did for us. And because it's about his grace, it's still dependent upon him. His final argument is this: God holds our ultimate destiny in his hands. But the thing is, I want to just almost revisit a point here, but I think it's just so important, is those of us who live with that hope of resurrection, us Christians here who know what Jesus has done, accepted his sacrifice and his forgiveness, and have picked up our cross and gone to follow him, those of us who know that hope of resurrection, we shouldn't be looking towards eternity. We should be looking at the present. You know, those people who live for eternity, who have a trust that God is in control of their eternity and their ultimate destiny, they don't have to worry about what's going to happen in the future because that's already done. That's not dependent upon us. That's not dependent on anything we can do. That's all dependent upon Him. Therefore, eternity is not something we have to worry about, not something we have to think about. The people who live for eternity live present in the moment they've been given. Because there are moments stretching to eternity that will all happen. But this moment right now will never happen again. The moment we live in will never happen again. The people who live in the hope of the resurrection should live as people who live in the moment. Because there's moments in the future, we know that God's in charge. But now has been given to me as a gift. And so the teacher comes to his conclusion. His argument is this. God is in control of time. Even when it seems that things are difficult and there's suffering and injustice, God has a plan, a purpose, and is present even in those places. God holds our ultimate destiny in his hands. Therefore, how does the wise person live? What does the wise person do? They be content. It's so simple. But the wise person is content in the moment they've been given. You want to make the most of your time? Be content in the moment you've been given. Good or ill. If you want to make the most of life, you just live contentedly in the moment. You embrace the gift of life you've been given now. You enjoy the work that God has placed before you and know that the work that he does is the only work that's going to last forever. You don't worry about the future because he's already there and he's already got it sorted. You're fully present in the moment, receiving the gifts that God has given us. You seek justice by all means. The wise person seeks justice but knows ultimately it is God's to meet out in his time. And we live present in every moment given to us, with our friends, with our family, with our work colleagues. The wise person is content. Let's just pray. Father, I just want to apologize to you for the times that I have neglected the gift of the time you have given me. I want to apologize for the times where I've been in the valley and I have railed against you instead of realizing that even in the valley you are there, and even in the valley you have something to teach me, and that that will end and there will be times of mountaintop again. Father, we just pray you would make us a people who are fully present in the life that you have given us. Father, we just pray that the world would look and see of people who are so confident in their God's control of this world that they aren't urgent in their action. That, Lord, we would just be a people just following you, dedicated to you, and just sure of the grace you have given us, the mercy you have shown us, and the power that you have. Father, help us to live present. Amen.